Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. This is episode number 561. This week we've got a great interview happening with Brother Bob Cooper, the prior grand historian, I think recently retired, and it's all thanks to one of our legacy partner contributors, Brother Chris Stebbins, Worshipful Brother Chris Stebbins. So, with that said, stick around for this awesome interview coming right up. Masonic Education on Demand. With new episodes every week and a 10-year catalog, you'll always find something to listen to. Over 1,140 research papers have been read on the show, all for free. There's no catch. Listen to the WCY podcast on any of your favorite podcast players or direct on our website. Listen today to the number one trusted Masonic and related education podcast in the world. Every Sunday night at 9:30 Central. Always on the level. All right, everybody, we're back this week. We have a special guest with us, joining us, as we had last time, Brother Christian Stebbins, who brought on a very special guest, and he's done the same thing this time with a very big surprise. We scrambled a little bit to make this happen, but it was just so important and such an opportunity to be able to do this. So, Brother Chris, if you would be kind and introduce our two special guests.
Absolutely. Thank you, Robert. It's always a pleasure to be on the show and really appreciate it. So I'm super excited to be with Brother Robert L.D. Cooper from the Grand Lodge of Scotland, who happens to be visiting us in New Jersey. That's why we scrambled to kind of put this together really quick. Thought it would be an amazing opportunity to share Brother Cooper with the show and with your listeners, although I'm sure many of them are familiar. So, Bob, say hello.
Good evening.
And also with us is Brother Bob Howard, who is a friend of mine and mentor, and he is the architect of this trip. Bob and I have been getting into lots of trouble together in New Jersey and making some great things happen, and we're excited to have Brother Bob Cooper join us here. And we have a neat event coming up this weekend, which is one of the reasons why he's here.
It's great to be
here.
Yeah,
this is really fantastic. I mean, basically, if the audience at home is not familiar, for me, the first time I saw Brother Bob from Scotland was on the television, when he was on talking about various different things within the Masonic fraternity, kind of dispelling some of the mystery, but at the same time not doing the typical kind of thing where people are like, there's no mysteries in Freemasonry. In fact, the way Brother Bob talked about it was very intriguing, and was actually one of the first documentaries. It was a two-part DVD back in the day when Netflix would send DVDs out. And there was this two-part DVD set that I sent away for to get just so I could watch this thing. And Brother Bob was speckled and peppered throughout the documentary, and it was really interesting. My wife watched it, and we had a great time. And since, we've seen you on many different things. We follow you on Facebook and other various social media platforms and things. So it's just incredible to have you guys on. This is awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Our pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. We should also thank our hosts. We're in Well, is this, would we call this Boiling Spring Lodge, although the members...
Think you have to call it Eclipse Lodge number 67.
Right.
Is that the name of the lodge?
Yes.
Is that,
that's your lodge?
I'm just testing the EAs to see if they know the name of their lodge.
It's your lodge, Bob. Sorry, we have some EAs that are off camera that are hanging out here to meet Brother Cooper, too.
Yeah. This is we think this is a great opportunity for EAs to see something special. And, you know, this, I know when I was a young Mason, when I was involved in things like this, this really gave me some encouragement. And, you know, there's a lot more to Masonry than just collation.
definitely agree with you there. It certainly adds to the fire, I think. You know, had I been an entered apprentice and then, you know, somebody stuck me in the room with a Masonic celebrity, I probably would have just doubled down and been that much more invested in the craft. And I think that's really special. So one of the things that you mentioned here just in the opener was that you have an event happening. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this event that's happening?
Bob?
Cooper is more passionate about this and is closer in age to the subject matter. So maybe he can tell
Thank
us.
You for that. Well, okay, very, very simply, my interest in Freemasonry has, for a long time, has been about the period prior to 1717. And of course, everybody would immediately say, well, not much happened before 1717. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. There's a lot of material in Scotland dating from the late 16th century in Scotland. But for the purpose of this event, this weekend, it was a real delight to discover that the first known Freemason in North America was a man called John Skeen, who was a member of the Masonic Lodge in Aberdeen. And he arrived here in New Jersey in 1681, or 1682, or thereabouts. And he stayed here until he died. And, of course, having the first actual initiated speculative Freemason in the whole of North America in this part of the world is a very, very important thing to investigate, research, and indeed celebrate.
So Bob Howard and I put together an event which is experimental in nature, but the burial site of John Skeen is within Burlington County in New Jersey. Bob, you want to tell us a little about the site?
Yeah, the site is right off of Exit 5 off the Turnpike. It's in a place called the Peach Field, which was an area where John Skeen lived. He was buried there August 27th, 1687, and that's why we're having this memorial event on August 27th. And we're trying to make this an annual affair. So we also want this to be sort of a union between the local community and Freemasonry. We want, you know, because he's important to the community because he was an early pioneer and an early settler. But he's important to us because he was the first Freemason in North America. And there's a good opportunity for there to be a nice, collaboration between the local population and Freemasonry. And there's another little twist that I think is interesting, because John Skeen was also a Quaker. Now, there's a Quaker community in that part of New Jersey. And, you know, it would be nice if we, you know, all three of us, all communities got together and kind of commemorated this guy who was really important to all of us for maybe different reasons, but there's a nexus for several communities to really get to know each other and share our history together. Mm. So that's really what we're doing. We're having a kind of a burial ceremony, Masonic, a little bit of a Masonic ceremony. And, then we're going to have a repast afterwards. So we're going to have, somebody give a paper. And next year we want to do this again, but on a larger scale. Maybe invite, some grandmasters, you know, maybe I would love to the worshipful master of Aberdeen Lodge, maybe to show up. That would be great. Maybe the grandmaster of Scotland, maybe the grandmaster of, Pennsylvania, New York. And you know, it's our history. It's not just New Jersey history. It's history of the whole region. So, you know, that in a nutshell is why we brought Bob Cooper here. Yeah. I think Bob is really trying to raise the flag for Scotland, because Scotland there's so much that we have to thank Scotland for in terms of Freemasonry. You know, George Washington was made a Mason in a Scottish lodge, you know, Scottish Freemason. Yeah, yeah. George Washington was a Freemason.
Get out of town. Yeah. Well, this is really interesting, this idea that you're bringing all these kind of communities together for a number of reasons. Number one, I mean, Freemasonry and community has always been this really interesting dynamic where Masonry has always stood for, you know, equality and bring and raising the standards of living and things of their communities. And so we've been seen that way largely here in America. But in the same sense, it was, I had no idea that John Skeen was also a Quaker. And when I hear about this, I just start, you know, my mind starts reeling because the Quakers essentially are a massive spiritual influence here in America. And this is just really incredible. And the fact that he's both a Mason and a Quaker is, I can only imagine the kinds of things that this particular brother, you know, had a mind for. Thinking about, Bob, you had mentioned that he's from the lodge in Aberdeen, and we definitely know that, of course, before 1717, Masonry has been around a very long time. We've got the oldest lodge in the world in Scotland, and when we're thinking about this kind of thing, or this kind of, this kind of wave here, I'm just curious, we also know that, like, the third degree and some of these other, after degrees, right? Like, in these early days, you had mentioned 15th century, are we looking at John Skeen as a speculative Mason in those times as well? Or was he at least, or was he versed in some sort of Masonry? What are your thoughts around this?
Well, John Skeen is the starting point of a truly remarkable story. And I think we can really build on this, certainly for next year. He was a merchant, so he was not a stonemason as such. So he was a speculative Mason. In fact, the lodge that he was a member of, 80% of the membership were not stonemasons. So it was dominated by speculative Masons. But the really interesting thing about Skeen being here as a speculative Mason and a merchant is the fact that within a year or two, he's joined by another Freemason, but this time an operative Mason by the name of John Coburn. And John Coburn was an operative Mason from the lodge in Melrose in the Scottish Borders. So you have John Skeen, speculative Freemason, meeting an operative Mason also from Scotland, and they seem to go into business together. John Skeen, the merchant, he's got the money and the business acumen, and John Coburn is the guy that can actually put the stonework together. So it looks like they are one of the first building contractors here in the colonies, and that research is ongoing. But that to me is a tremendous connection that only happens here in the New World, where you've got a speculative and an operative working together, but of course they would be performing exactly the same ceremonies, even although they are from completely different backgrounds. And we do know that John Coburn is encouraging other Scots operative Masons to come here, because he writes to his lodge encouraging other members to emigrate to this part of the world because the business opportunities are enormous. What we've started to do now is try and track down any existing buildings that these this two may have actually built, and that could be a really exciting research project.
That would be absolutely fascinating to be able to pinpoint something, especially on the East Coast, where we have such a push in preservation in a lot of our earlier colonial buildings and things. Bob, let me ask this really quickly as well. Because of these ideas of early Masons, you know, there's a lot of brothers out there who are new, including our entered apprentices here, that may or may not know that there has not always been like the 3 degrees and the same kinds of systems, put in place. And so I'm just curious, can you, like, when we know that John Skeen is a Mason and Coburn is a Mason and these guys of this kind of era, are we assuming that they are essentially what we would call they've received a degree, 2 degrees? Is the Royal Arch involved at this point? Like, I'm just curious on your thoughts there in the historicity of it all.
Well, we know for certain it would be 2 degrees, and they were known as this, they are known today, entered apprentice and fellow of craft. But there is a revelation that we could perhaps make on Saturday, that we now think the 3rd degree was in existence at exactly the same time. And that comes from rereading a document that we can perhaps make public on Saturday, just to give a little bit of a zing to the day, shall we say.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't know that was coming. That's a great surprise.
You heard it here first. Wow. That's incredible history. Part of this celebration of coming over here and celebrating John Skeen, and since you're over here, what have you been doing, and you know, have you been going to lodge and touring, or what's been your experience so far?
Oh, gosh, lots and lots of things, lots of talking. Masons are good at talking, so, and, you know, I could talk for Scotland if it was an Olympic sport. So that's been very enjoyable, good fun, good fellowship. And, of course, tonight I'm in the company of 3 entered apprentices. We're doing a little bit of education, a little bit of encouragement, and that's been interesting to me, because our mentoring program is nothing like what I've seen this evening. So I've got some ideas to take home as well. So, you know, when you go to visit other jurisdictions, you learn. And that's one of the best things that you can do within Freemasonry, as you know, is visit other Freemasons, other lodges.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Anytime I go, I always, you know, if I go to do a talk or something else, but what I find myself doing is always asking everybody else, like, well, how do you do this? How do you do that? Let me ask Brother Howard, how did you connect with Brother Bob? We have 3 Roberts here, so it's kind of funny. So, Brother Howard, how did you connect with Brother Bob?
Oh, it's very interesting. First, I had a thirst for knowledge when I was a young Mason, and I began to read as much as I could. I had a mentor in my lodge who pointed me in various directions and got me to reading certain things. And then I noticed that there were symposiums given around the world. And I would go to Alexandria, Virginia. There'd be symposia there where I could learn some things, because I was really interested in what the eggheads had to say about Masonry. You know, the people who had, you know, who put footnotes in their research, as opposed to people who just speculated or supposed, you know, like so many of the popular books that we read, which are based on opinions and what ifs. So I started reading, let's say, the right books. I went to symposia, and there was actually a symposium in Edinburgh in 2013 that I went to, and oh man, there were all the people who published real papers on Masonry were there at that symposium, and one of the key figures was Bob Cooper. So I got to get to know Bob. I had some libation and some refreshment in his backyard. He was kind enough to take me to Roslyn Chapel and give me a personal tour. So, you know, it was just a question of following my thirst for knowledge. And when you do that, you meet people. So I met Bob Cooper, but in the same process, I met so many other people, Mark Cabot, you know, who's, George Washington, National Memorial in Alexandria. At the same symposium, I met Andrew Hammer, you know, who speaks about observant Freemasonry. You know, in the process, I met some very interesting people. It was just a question of having the thirst, but also taking the next step and actually going outside of my normal spheres, to look for something interesting. And that's all history now. Ever since then, I've had some communication with Bob. I've seen him around, and this is my second, time traveling with him in the U.S. He was here just back in March, and we did a number of things at that time. So, you know, he's raising the level here in New Jersey. Every time he comes, it's always something, you know, it's very interesting for all the people who get to meet him. And, you know, one of the things that I find is interesting is he talks about Freemasonry, the facts. He talks about the real history that can be proven. But he demonstrates that the real information, the real facts can be very interesting. The real, story behind Freemasonry is terribly exciting. We don't have to make up, you know, fanciful stories about what ifs. The real story is exciting enough. That's how I met Bob Cooper.
I love that. The idea that the real story is enough. The ordinary is extraordinary. The things in your life that seem ordinary are historically amazing. Just like a lot of our history, you know, I think I remember the first time I my brain just got smashed, right? When I was reading the stories, one of the first Masonic books I had read was one called A House Undivided, which, you know, detailed the Civil War, and some stories that went along with it. But they were all, you know, very anecdotal. There wasn't a lot of citations and footnotes and bibliography, right? It was a lot of hearsay. And then a past Grand Master, Mike Halloran, you know, he published a book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, a fantastic book. And in the first couple chapters, he basically destroys some of these anecdotes, and I was crushed. But then I was lifted up again by the even more incredible things that he had reported on that were backed up by newspaper articles, journals, you name it. And I just thought, like, wow, you know, it's like when I was a kid, I would order these books, Stranger Than Fiction. And it's the same thing in Masonic history. We have, just extraordinary happenings, that are better than anything you could ever make up. So I absolutely love that and appreciate it. Brother Chris, what are you going to be doing for this event? Do you have anything that you've planned on doing? Do you have to deliver anything or, just
so,
running some?
I'm in the background for the most part, helping to put the day together since it's in my neck of the woods in New Jersey instead of Brother Howard's. So putting together, you know, the logistics, but also, we wrote some toasts, some custom toasts for the event that I hope will please Brother Cooper. Brother Jack Heide is my partner in crime in writing those. Plug for Brother Jack again. He's the one who turned me on to your show, Robert. So he's a great partner in my lodge for this kind of activity. So we've got some toasts. I'll be wearing my kilt, my family tartan. Connell is my mother's maiden name, so I think I'm the last of my bloodline that can wear the tartan legally in Scotland. So I'll be wearing my kilt, although it's, you know, August 27th in New Jersey and it's going to be like 95 degrees. So I'm not.
What better time to wear it?
What better time to wear the kilt? But that's okay. So yeah, we'll dress up or we'll have some toast. But this is experimental. So as Brother Howard mentioned, we're doing the memorial kind of service first, and then we will retire for the repast. For, you know, a nice meal and a couple of toasts. I'm excited.
It sounds like an awesome event.
Too bad it's the 27th. Sorry, Alex. I'm not coming to Kansas, which is one of my original plans, but.
So, Brother Bob, what are your plans for this, during this event? Are you going to be doing, some speaking? Are you taking part in the ceremony?
I think my main task, being a native Scot, will be to lay the wreath. We did the same last year. We had a very nice wreath with the Aberdeen Lodge logo on it, and we do the same thing again. Get some photo opportunities, maybe some publicity, certainly some publicity for next year's event, and no doubt we'll say a few nice words about John Skeen and how important he was, not just for Freemasonry in general, but for New Jersey in particular. So, as Chris says, a little bit experimental, and I do tend to ad lib quite a lot, so you can never be quite sure what I'm going to say, because I'm never sure what I'm going to say.
Spoiler alert, we're going to invite him to give a toast, and we it's going to be completely extemporaneous, and it's going to be great.
Amazing. One thing, you had mentioned that John was a merchant. Now, in these times of merchants and traveling all around, we see a lot of it, in particular, there's a lot of focus on, like, let's say the Scottish Rite, with the merchants who went around and essentially had patents to deliver the degrees from the Lodges of Perfection and these kinds of things. Do we know that, like John Skeen, when, as a merchant and traveling abroad, do we know if he had any sort of, patents or anything where he was allowed to confer degrees or start a lodge?
Short answer is no, and that's something of great regret to me. If you have someone like John Skeen, a speculative Mason, John Coburn, an operative Mason, it would seem to be the ultimate for them to form a lodge here in New Jersey. We've got no way of knowing that. Certainly there was no Grand Lodge, of course, at this time. So there was no authority to apply for a warrant or a charter. But I can't imagine that you've got two guys who know the ritual, who have been initiated in different parts of the country, don't get at least talking about Freemasonry here in New Jersey. Now, whether they held unofficial meetings or meetings that are simply not recorded, that would not surprise me, but we cannot prove it, unfortunately.
It certainly seems as though, being before, this 1717 or the 1721, whoever wants to believe what on this, we know Freemasonry exists a long time before, didn't really worry about, I hate to say this, because my grandmaster might smirk at me for saying, like, the silly rules of, having all of this proper documentation and lineage lines and things of this nature, right? When you've got two brothers who are going to come together and put on, have a meeting or a meal or a festive board. We've got so much history that shows, like, in the United States or the westward colonization where, Masons traveling west over the Colorado Rockies had square and compasses made of paper that they used to meet, impromptu. And it's not an official meeting. They just opened with whose authority? Their own.
Exactly. Yeah. This, what we're talking about really is the transference of legitimacy from one Masonic lodge to another. And we know this took place before John Skeen even arrived here. And the best example is Lodge Canongate Kilwinning, just outside Edinburgh. They wrote to Lodge Kilwinning, Lodge Mother Kilwinning, at number zero, in 1677 for permission to form a lodge just outside Edinburgh. So they were seeking the legitimacy from another lodge to form a lodge because there were no grand lodges. Now, it's not impossible that Skeen or Coburn or both of them either wrote to Aberdeen or wrote to Melrose saying, we're here in New Jersey. Do you give your blessing to us to create a Masonic lodge? And that blessing may have been given, but is simply not recorded. And that's a lovely thought, I have to say, that would happen. And I, I would err on the positive side and say that that probably did happen, but as a historian, I just can't prove it.
Well, I would just like to either make a point or ask a question. I think when John Skene was about to leave Scotland for the New World, his family was being persecuted. He personally and his family were severely persecuted for their religious beliefs. And, you know, back then, religion, culture, political perspective, it was all kind of related. You couldn't really separate it. You know, as a Quaker, he would have been perceived as disrespectful to the local magistrate and certainly insulting to the sensibilities of the average person of the time. So when he left Scotland, he was probably leaving in a bit of a rush. And I don't know that he would have, you know, maybe had the time to set up some type of protocol with his worshipful master and plan a proper, you know, transition, for a legitimate lodge in, the New World. I think his motivations were, different. You know, for us, we're purists. We think of Masons and taking a charter and getting a charter. And, you know, these are all Grand Lodge concepts that didn't even exist back then. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it was a different world, a different motivations. And maybe retrospectively, after the fact, he could have, you know, hey, you know, why don't we form a lodge? But certainly he didn't have the opportunity to do that in advance. So anyway, that's my thoughts. Yeah. I mean,
interesting.
So Bob, let me ask, we know we've seen you on TV and things. Is there anything that we've got that's coming up that you're excited about or any current research that you're doing that, we can look forward to as well?
There's a variety of things actually. Now that I've retired from Grand Lodge, I've now got more time to revisit some of the things that I've written. I've been asked, for example, that perhaps we should put together a compendium of papers of different sizes, different lengths, that many of which haven't been published, and give a kind of a complete sweep of my interests in a compendium. That could be done relatively quickly. Also, a revised and updated edition of the Free Gardener's book is something that really should be done, because there's been 20 years since it was first published, and we've learned a lot about that particular order in that last 20 years. So that's something that's on the horizon. But I'm also in the awkward position of having almost too many projects to undertake, and deciding which ones should be done first. There was I was supposed to give a presentation at the Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario. Unfortunately, the flight was cancelled, as seems to be quite common these days. But the title of that, which would be a book eventually, the title was The Confessions of a Haggis Smuggler. So that was to be anecdotes of my Masonic travels over the world over the last 30, 40 years. And of course, I did actually smuggle haggis on a on a regular basis, hence the title. So lots of possibilities in the fairly near future.
That sounds hilarious. The title of the book actually will stick with me for a long time. And, you know, I'm just, to my close friends and anybody listening to the show, we're going to push Bob to release this, the memoirs of Bob Cooper. Fantastic. So, Brother Howard, you had mentioned earlier that you've got EAs there. One thing that I was curious on, with Brother Bob here as well, you have likely seen differences in your approach that you've mentioned. What is something, I think, you know, can we compare and contrast a little bit? Because I know that here in the States, depending on our grand jurisdiction, we certainly instruct our candidates a little bit different from grand jurisdiction to grand jurisdiction, but there are large differences that I've noticed with our European brothers, whether that's in the UK, Scotland, England, you know, or Germany, Italy, whatever the case might be. Can we talk a little bit about the different approaches?
Yeah, I mean, the different approaches basically are because every Grand Lodge is sovereign. And so you have people who take a particular view of Masonic education that can be quite different from the from people in the jurisdiction next door. And nobody, you know, there is no central body. It's not like the church where you have a Vatican that kind of lays down, you know, the dogma. So what's happened is that the education, the dogma, the interpretation has all been developed by each individual jurisdiction. And we were just talking earlier on, with our entered apprentices about the landmarks. Mackie's landmarks. And that's a classic example of how education diverges from place to place, because one person says one thing and another person says another, and rarely does it become revised. It becomes stuck that for that jurisdiction, that is what you're going to be telling your members. I think the idea that we have now is that perhaps we need to agree at least some basics across the world, or at least across continents, so that we don't end up with arguing with ourselves as to what certain thing means. So that's my elementary thinking on it. I know Bob has got other thoughts on it too, but it's a tricky question, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I would say what I like to do is look at education from two perspectives. One is focus on the ritual. Everything about Freemasonry is in the ritual. And what we need to do is decipher the symbolism and allegory and see how we can take those lessons and apply them to our lives. I think they're meant to be, you know, people talk about, oh, well, these are esoteric, deep concepts. Well, they were actually meant not to be so deep. They're supposed to be pretty obvious. You know, the symbolism of the beehive, for example, you know, that's supposed to be clear. You know, the 24-inch gauge, you know, that's supposed to be clear. How to divide your day and how to apply, you know, emphasis in different areas with the right balance, you know. It shouldn't take contemplation of a sage. So the point is, let's focus on the ritual. What does the ritual have to teach us? But the second point is, what's the historical context? Where did this ritual come from? You know, where's the history? You know, you can trace the ritual back to the ancient charges of operative guilds, you know, where they would take a young, maybe 7-year-old, maybe a 12-year-old, and start to educate him with just verbal lectures about the ancient charges, so that he would understand. By the time he was a grown man, he would have had years of hearing these ancient charges and understanding his responsibilities, his obligations, and he would have learned from these ancient charges. And that's an operative Mason, you know, the Shaw statutes, you know, that's where we start to get some real structure in operative masonry that finds its way into speculative masonry. So I focus on the ritual, but I also think it's important to talk about the historical context, where it came from. And I also, you know, who wrote the ritual? It's important to talk about Preston. It's important to talk about Webb. You know, what was kept? What was thrown out? What do we need to go back to?
Why? Why were things kept or thrown out?
What's that?
And the why, if that's knowable.
Yeah.
Why things were retained?
Well, you know, Webb will tell you it was just too complicated for simple Americans. Right. You know, that's what Webb would say. But what I was going to say, okay, for instance, the Middle Chamber lecture. The Middle Chamber lecture is fine. It's a great it's a great lecture. But if you really want to understand the Middle Chamber lecture, you got to go back to the original Preston work, where it's much more expanded. At the time, it was read. And it was not, you know, it wasn't intended to be memorized, but it was very detailed, very interesting. And I admonish any fellow craft to go to Preston's work. So the ritual is great. That's where all the answers are. But if you really want to learn a lot more and expand your horizons, you got to look at the historical context. So that's my thoughts.
Because Brother Howard and I have this relationship, I can be contrarian with him a little bit. I'll agree and disagree at the same time if that's possible. So I think you're right about the getting back to basics, right? The foundation of any experience is the ritual and understanding the ritual and contemplating the ritual. And there is certainly surface level and, you know, surface level meaning and surface level interpretation that is applicable to our daily lives, that is simple teachings. But you mentioned about it doesn't require the contemplation of a sage. Well, once you've applied those lessons and the surface level lessons and structured your life, I think that frees you up to have the ability to contemplate like a sage and go and plumb those depths a little bit deeper. Mm. Not everybody goes on that journey, but we all share the common root. And I think the root of a good educational experience for Freemasonry starts with, as you said, that foundation of truly understanding the ritual, the basic principles, and the surface symbolism, because that gives us that common ground and the order necessary for us to transcend or contemplate like a sage for those of us that go that distance.
No, I agree 100%.
So we weren't disagreeing.
Not really disagreeing. Yeah. For instance, again, in the Middle Chamber lecture, we get the tools. These tools are now given to us and we learn the seven liberal arts and sciences. You know, we learn about them and now it's up to us to take it to the next step. What I'm saying is the ritual itself is a clear path. It's not meant to be obscure. So if you listen to the Middle Chamber lecture, you learn about the seven liberal arts and sciences. Okay, now you've just been given a tool. Run with it. You know, and I agree with you 100%. So I think Masonry kind of teaches us to walk before we can run. Mm-hmm. You know.
So one of the relevant to Saturday, we are blessed with the fact of knowing the ritual that both Skene and Coburn would have used when they were initiated in Scotland before they came here. So we'll perhaps make a bit of a mention of that on Saturday. And that's the earliest known rituals in the world from 1696. So you're going as far back ritual-wise as it's possible to go, and then trying to understand what these guys of 300-odd years ago were meaning, because language changes, the meaning of words change. That in itself is a very interesting sort of intellectual, educational exercise. What did those words mean 300 years ago compared to what they mean today? Mm. So we can get towards a better understanding of what they were trying to say then and compare to what we're saying today. And that's a very interesting.
This is such a huge undertaking, actually, that to what Brother Howard, when you were talking about the context and the historicity there, and Brother Cooper, you were talking about understanding what they meant at that time, this is something that evades, I would say, I don't want to be mean, but probably 99% of the craft brethren who go to Lodge, and even our brothers who are excellent at ritual, don't always stop to understand what exactly those words mean. Like, they might understand what they mean by today's standards, but, you know, when we think about what words like justice meant in the 1700s even, just looking at the historical context there, versus what we think it means today, you know, there are vast differences, and it's not just a difference in the language in terms of a maybe an archaic tongue, we'll say, but now we also have to understand that, yes, it sounds different, and it actually likely means a lot of different things as well. So this is a fantastic point you brought up. How do you think, a question for all three of you, how and what is the best way, and how can we get our brothers to, I guess, become well-informed in this way, to allow them to explore the ritual in a way that gets them to understand what it meant at the time it was written, and not necessarily implying what it means based on the understanding of the words today?
Well, the first, perhaps the most important point to make, this is common, this is not a criticism, Scottish documents from 200-300 years ago were translated into English using English language dictionaries. And there's nothing wrong in that. It's simply because there was no Scottish language dictionaries in existence when these translations were being made. So now that we have, the Scottish National Dictionary was completed in 1979, we can now look back 300 years ago and translate Scottish documents using a Scottish dictionary. And that reveals a variety of errors that English translators made through no fault of their own. And that gives us a different understanding of the words that the Scottish masons were using compared to what the English translators thought they were using or meaning. So that's a very interesting exercise. And it's actually, you know, to actually do that, there is a program, a kind of lecture, a presentation to actually do that. And that's like a voyage of exploration that begins to reveal things that we simply don't think about at all today. So that's an important point. And it's people like me that continually remind, our translators that there's more than one, dictionary can be used, for these very important documents, for example.
I think this is you've posed a really great question that, you know, how do we put brothers on a path to be successful, to, you know, both understand the context and the historicity and the historical context? I think is certainly a challenge. And it harkens, I'm sort of thinking back to your earlier question about the differences in education between jurisdictions. It's not just each Grand Lodge is sovereign, but each lodge is almost somewhat sovereign, right? They're under a loose set of, you know, rules that forms a Grand Lodge, but each lodge sort of has a lot of control over its own experience. So like the how is almost a what works for you maybe, but I think it also requires well-informed brethren who are willing to instruct without dogma or without a, you know, latching onto a specific path, right? Willing to instruct, but also willing to allow the mentee to question and explore at the same time, right? Because if you're an instructor, but you come from a place of dogma where you're latched onto one specific, you know, one specific theory, one specific interpretation, one specific use of the language, then, you know, you're stifling the critical experience, the critical thinking and you know, the stretching of the mind there.
I just want to add one other thing. It might sound a little more cynical, but
you're never cynical.
But it is. I think all of us, I'm pretty confident I can say this, that all of us have felt or been exposed to some pressure you know, to get along. All right. We are Masons who have been struck by a passion for research, for learning, asking more questions. People like us should be encouraged. There are people like us in every lodge who maybe are not going to be the guy who helps out with the fish fry or helps out with the beefsteak dinner, but would be very happy to do lodge research to put together some history of the lodge, who would like to do some reports on some interesting books he read, would like to maybe do some lecturing to new Masons. But I'm not saying it's done maliciously, but maybe it's done inadvertently. But we're kind of, if not ostracized, certainly marginalized in lodges because we don't focus on maybe some of the more popular things that the lodge is focused on.
Your mileage may vary in that context, though. I know that, you know, you personally have experienced that, and I'm sure a lot of brethren who listen to this podcast have experienced that. But, you know, Robert, I will kind of want to plug like Brother Randy Sanders' writing on this subject, right? Because I think he has a great point of view where it's like, let everybody practice their brand of Masonry, and that live and let live attitude allows us with an educational bent to also flourish, right? Like it's not an us versus them mentality. It's we're creating a culture that we can promote education, promote deep thinking, you know, promote that, that relationship and also have the fish fries if that's what the other brethren want to do.
No, it's not us or them. Yeah. What I'm saying is if your lodge is 99% focused on the fraternal aspects of the craft, that's fine. But understand the value of somebody who has an educational bent. You know, let him run. Even if you're the worshipful master and you want to focus on getting that beefsteak going and making money for that fundraiser. Okay, you want to make money for a fundraiser, whatever it is. That's all great. That's all part of Masonry. But you have a guy like me who likes to read, who likes to report, who likes to present. Okay, encourage me. Give me something to do. Don't do what you can to make sure that I leave the fraternity, which is unfortunately what I'm seeing. People like us aren't part of the mainstream, so we're not encouraged. All I'm saying is recognize that there are different people in your lodge. We now live in a spirit of inclusiveness. That's the world we live in today. Okay, well, include me.
Yeah. What you're saying, Bob, is that there are a small number of Masons who are isolated, in the sense that their interests are not catered for by the majority. And that's the way it is. If we recognize that that's the case, then perhaps something could be done about it. But this is not just New Jersey. It's not just the United States. It's the whole world where nearly every lodge has one or two people who have that particular kind of interest in Masonry, but there's nobody else that they can talk to or discuss it with. And they eventually feel, well, I'm not getting out of Masonry what I would like to get out of Masonry. And that's when you see them drift off.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to count myself lucky then, because I think, you know, my lodge was, you know, your traditional fundraiser, Scotch and Stogies type lodge. And then when I became interested and passionate about education and with some of the younger brothers that came in, we became passionate about it. And we kind of did it on the side for a while. But the side project snowballed to the point where it was as big or bigger than the main activities of the lodge, and therefore became more integrated into the primary activities of the lodge rather than being a sidecar, because it was as big or bigger than in some instances those activities. So the snowball effect was palpable. I think also a little bit of it sometimes is you have to try, you know, you don't want to eat your vegetables, but sometimes when you try it, you like it, right? There are brethren who, and maybe I'll count myself in this because I'm, you know, 11 years a Mason now, but I've only been as education oriented as I am now for a handful of years. And that's, you know, you don't know until you try it, or you don't know if you never knew that it existed. right? So somebody gives you a vegetable you've never tried before and you're reluctant. You're like, ew, I don't want to try that Masonic education. That looks dusty and boring. But then you try it and it's exciting. And then you realize you were wrong and that's okay, right? Yeah. And there is a snowball effect there. Yeah. I guess I'm proud of my lodge for having that. And we kind of have it all. Yeah. We have a St. Patrick's Day party that is a blowout fundraiser. It raises great funds. It's a great party. It has nothing to do with Freemasonry other than we do a great charity for the local, community. We do that. We do educational speakers. We do stuff in our community, and we certainly do plenty of Scotch and Stogies. We do it all. That's something for everybody.
Yeah, good. Well, I think you made my point. I think if somebody like you is allowed to flourish in your lodge, you can bring that level of education in a way that's palatable, enjoyable, and complements everything else that's going on in Freemasonry. And that's what Masonry is. It's a complex fraternity offering a lot of different things that I think you've given us like the perfect example of what could happen. But my point is there's going to be one guy typically in a lodge who's got this spark and he should be encouraged. You know, that's all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Encourage that guy because it's that one guy. He's the entrepreneur of education. You know, let him run with it and he's going to bring other people in, excite other people. You EAs, aren't you excited about coming into our lodge?
Oh, yeah, I am.
All right, see? There you are.
Good. Good.
And he's like, good answer. I'm not going to inhibit your progress.
He didn't bribe them before asking that. So, Robert, I did want to go back. You had asked.
Please do.
You had asked about the differences in jurisdictions. And way earlier in the conversation, Brother Cooper had mentioned that while he was observing the mentoring session, before the podcast this evening, he learned some things that he wanted to take back. So I wanted to ask, what did you see that was really interesting to you in our mentoring? Well, let me be clear. Brother Howard's mentoring at Eclipse Lodge, which is probably nothing like what we do in my lodge, but I don't know. So I want to hear.
Well, it's, again, mentoring back home tends to be right. We're going to tell you what to do. Whereas Bob's approach was, here's some homework for you to do. So I put it as simply as that. So instead of being just simply receiving information, you're having to think for yourself about the information. And I think that's just a different attitude, a different approach. It's a different approach I've never seen before because we've got into the habit of we will have a lodge of instruction. Somebody will take a turn of giving the ritual of a senior warden or whatever. And we've got ourselves into that kind of a rut, whereas Bob's not in that rut at all. It's a different kind of thing. You go away, you enter apprentices, have got to go away and do some work on your own at home. And I think that's a very interesting concept.
Good job, brother. Oh,
well, you know, sometimes even a broken clock is right. Yeah.
You know, as the things that you guys have all mentioned in terms of how we are teaching our brothers and mentoring them and treating them. These are universal lessons, I think, around, just across the board, we'll say. I have certainly witnessed what Brother Howard, what you've been talking about. I've been on the receiving end of such, kinds of, I don't know, exchanges, I guess you could call them. And, you know, one of the things that is definitely frustrating is that you never know the expertise that an entered apprentice or a brand new master mason might have. And when you shut them down, you're essentially telling them that there's no way you can serve your lodge. And this is a problem. But I'm starting to see a real change, and I've got a lot of great hope for the future. As you mentioned, this is an age of inclusion. And we're starting to see so many young brothers just take the reins and run with it. And I think something that, I mean, I've only been in, 12 or 13 years now myself. I have witnessed something within myself, which is that by encouraging our newest our newest brothers, we are allowing them to not only flourish, but take a burden off of us and other people who are doing so much of the work. And then you feel a relief. There's some anxiety because you're letting go of the reins a little bit. But in that same aspect, you're essentially hoisting them up. It's like that old quote, if I've seen further, it's by stepping on the shoulders of giants or something along those lines. And I think this is the way in masonry. We bring them in, we allow them to learn, we hoist them up, and we hopefully say, I take it farther than we were able to. Have you been able to, open question for anybody, have you had these kinds of relationships where you've been able to mentor somebody to take on like a larger position? And Brother Bob, I would really appreciate any words of wisdom you have in this area, right? Because you've recently retired from Grand Lodge and were involved there for so long.
Well, there's a whole variety of techniques that I think we should explore using. We were talking about this earlier on. Perhaps a one-day educational seminar, when lodges are dark, so you've got the time. We have study groups back home where they will pick a paper from, say, Quater Coronati, circulate it to the various members of the group, and then the next month discuss that paper, and then circulate another one. So there's all sorts of different techniques. Some will work in some parts of the world, some not in others. But the main thing is to actually make a start, to actually make the attempt. And if one technique fails, then you move on to another one in the hope it's going to succeed. And I mean, this event on Saturday with John Skeen, his memorial, that's not a formal educational program, but it could be the spark that starts something off. So you just keep trying all these different alternatives, and you never know where they're going to take you. It's the attempt that's important.
Yeah, that's a really important point about innovation and experimentation, right? See what works. And Freemasonry is local, right? Like, Freemasonry is really local. What works for one may not necessarily work for another, as long as we're all grounded in, the similar principles and, examining the ritual, right?
Hmm. Yeah, I think you brought up a good point about Masonry being local, and it also complements something else you said about the sovereignty of the local lodge. If we look for our answers at the lodge level, I think we're going to be fine. It's our brethren, it's our officers, it's our worshipful master, it's our past masters who have the answers for us. It's right there. Make that family of yours work. It's nice that there's a district deputy who's helping us, and it's nice that there's a district ritual instructor. It's nice that there's a Grand Lodge, but rely on your brethren. And I think that's the key. And support your brethren. You were supported, Christian, and you were able to give tenfold to what you probably got out of Freemasonry. You were able to give back to your lodge, and that was all internal. That was not from any edict, any guidance. Was all from your lodge. So look to your lodge. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. If you're looking for help, look no further than first start at the end of your own right arm and then, or left arm, then look at your neighboring brethren, right? They're the ones who are there to help you. I think that makes a lot of sense. Although I will give a plug. I heard that the Grand Lodge of New Jersey does have an excellent mentoring program of which you, may have been a participant or architect of.
Yeah. I should mention that one of the things that I'm involved with is I've taken what we had as a Grand Lodge mentoring program that was sort of lost in our on our website somewhere. I actually took it out, reworked it, and created an 8-hour presentation that we now give. I have a number of people that I work with. We have about eight facilitators. We'll go out to a district will bring just a small number together, maybe 30 potential mentors. So we have maybe one or two people from each lodge in a district or two districts, and we'll go through the Grand Lodge Mentoring Program, and we'll familiarize everyone with what tools are available and also some techniques on how to make education palatable, exciting. And boy, these guys are so motivated. At the end of the day, they're so excited and they can't wait to get back to their lodge to unleash what we shared with them.
And it's a Grand Lodge program.
Well, it's a Grand Lodge program. You know, I took, you know, myself and some of the other facilitators, we took the initiative.
What I like about that program, Bob, too.
What's that?
Sorry to interrupt. What I like about that program, too, is it's not like inherently Masonic per se. It's about the tools and like how to practically be a good mentor and an effective mentor.
Right. Right. So we try to let each individual mentor reach into himself and use his own tools. You know, there's not one way to be a mentor. In fact, we even encourage them, if there are other people in your lodge that you think know a little bit more about a topic, bring them into your program. Empower them to be part of the mentoring program in your lodge. Although this is something that we're doing with the Grand Lodge because it was the Grand Lodge Mentoring Program, what we're doing is empowering individuals in each lodge. Mm. And it's really up to them to do the work. So again, we're getting back to the individual, lodge. And you know what I find is encouraging? Every once in a while, we find somebody like Kristen who has already been doing some type of mentoring, and we learn from him. You know, we incorporate some of his techniques into our mentoring, you know, in terms of training the mentor. So there are already people who are out there highly motivated, highly experienced, and we don't really have anything to teach them, but we have a lot to learn from people like that. And it's very encouraging when we find them.
I like, Bob, that final point of, you know, Grand Lodge is providing some tools, but it's just an empowerment of the individual. So it's still local. Mm-hmm. It's not turning to Grand Lodge for all your answers and solving your problems.
And I think, quite honestly, that's what Grand Lodge is looking for. Yeah. They are looking for you to... They want each lodge to run with whatever they offer. You know, there's nothing happier than a district deputy who has successful lodges in his district. You know, so he could just stand back. He doesn't want to lecture you. He doesn't want to point out your flaws. He's just happy when things are going swimmingly.
This is all good information. Well, I want to thank my guests, Brother Chris, Bob, and Bob. Bob Cooper and Brother Bob Howard, for sharing some time with us. In, like I said, it was kind of a little bit crazy to get this to work, but I'm just so excited that we got it to work and that these brothers were able to spend a little bit of time with us to share some light and some experience cross-jurisdictionally. This was just fantastic. I want to pass it back over to Brother Chris for any closing thoughts and remarks, and then we'll go over to Bob and to Brother Bob as well. Bob and Bob.
Thanks, Brother Robert. I really appreciate having the opportunity, and I'm glad we were able to pull this off. I do want to give a shout-out to Worshipful Master Patrick Glover of Eclipse Lodge number 67, who has provided us the space so that we could do this this evening, and we sort of crashed their lodge's mentoring session, which I think actually was valuable. Would you say that, guys, that this was valuable?
I agree. We
kind of crashed and interrupted their mentoring session so we could put this together, but I think that was valuable. So I did want to thank Worshipful Brother Glover for facilitating and letting us have the space, and Brother Howard for letting me intervene in his mentoring session this evening. And thank you very much. And Bob, it's always phenomenal to get to spend some time with you.
Thanks. Yeah. I suppose the one thing that we should take the opportunity to plug is the event the first weekend in November at the George Washington National Masonic Memorial in Alexandria, Virginia, which is Scots Freemasons in North America. So it's a very specific subject, but it's not completely dry academic stuff. There's a lot of very interesting social activities going on as well. So find the memorial's website and look up how you register for that. I think it would be a fun weekend. I know places are limited, so I'm kind of mentioning that kind of early on for you.
Wonderful. I will actually, I'll put a just a link in the show notes back to the memorial. Brother Howard, anything closing remarks on your end?
Well, my last remark is one word, and that's travel. The secret of Freemasonry is travel. You know, if you have the opportunity to travel outside of your lodge, go to other lodges in your district. If you can travel outside of your state, meet other people, go to other lodges, see how they do things there. If you can get to another country, it'll even be more exciting and more different. And you learn so much and you meet people, and you make friends, you know. So the secret to Freemasonry, everybody wants to know what the secret is? It's travel.
Mm.
So that's my parting comments.
Powerful mic drop there. Well, it's hard to top that, although I was thinking I missed something that I want to interject real quick. Just a plug also for Brother Cooper's book, Cracking the Freemason's Code. I think that's a fantastic book for like the new Master Mason. I mean, I think the target audience there is also the general public, but I think, you know, we're using that in our lodge as a new Master Mason's text, because it's a great sort of tour of, you know, some origin theories, you know, a look at the early texts, you know, some explanation about the Free Gardeners, and it's just a great tour. So I want to plug that book, because I think it's just a great text for especially a new Master Mason, and we're using it in our lodge.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Well, that's awesome. I'll put a link back in the show notes as well to that text. Certainly, if anybody has any questions, comments, concerns, anything you'd like to ask, feel free to email the program, and I will direct those communications back to Christian so that he can forward them on to the proper folks. But gentlemen, brothers, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program.
Thank you. Thanks, Brother Robert. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Brother Bob Cooper, Brother Bob Howard, and Chris Stebbins. Again, Chris is one of our legacy partners and is one of these people who is constantly working for the betterment of Masonic education globally. It was an awesome effort that he had to help get this all together, and it's thanks to him that it happened at all. So if you happen to see Brother Chris Stebbins out there in the wild, give him a hearty handshake, a high five, a fist bump, whatever you feel comfortable with, and tell him thanks for all he's doing for Masonic education. Thank you, Chris. Thank you to Brother Bob Cooper, the, like I said, previous or prior grand historian of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, who was so generous with his time, and to Brother Bob Howard, who facilitated all of this in moving forward. So thank you guys so much. I understand the John Skeen event went great. I received photographs from some great brothers and sisters across the world who actually traveled to that event to check it out. So it's events like that that bring us all together. Before we leave this week, I want to give a shout out to one of our listeners who mentioned that in Brother Patrick Day's latest Masonic Mythbusters, where he talks about this Rosicrucian Hiramic legend, one of the words he used is, in fact, used in a known Masonic context. Brother Patrick Day, I let him know about it. He said it was super interesting, and I agree. You can find out all about it if you read The Secret School of Wisdom by Joseph Wages. Now, I've read that book, and it just totally slipped my mind, but I guess it is in there, and I verified it. So you need to check that out. I'll have a link to that book in the show notes as well. And again, thanks to every one of our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. And if you're curious on how you can help support Masonic education through the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. Now, I also do some other little side projects to raise money for the podcast, including Handmade Leather Works, and we've got our producer's pins, the bookstore, all of these great options that will assist this program getting Masonic education out to you and all those interested in the royal art, which is extremely important because we want legitimate, real, and trustworthy Masonic education going and filtering to the top. just like effervescence, right? So if that interests you, again, check out WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show, and see your options there. I really appreciate it, as well as anybody out there who is sharing, emailing, linking, or just liking, commenting, subscribing, all of those things to our YouTube channel, to the podcast, on Facebook, all of those different platforms. And I want to thank all those people who are making it possible that we'll be able to go live very soon on TikTok. If you follow me there, I am the Wizard of Arj, A-R-J, like a transliteration of RJ. But anyway, that's the underscore wizard underscore of underscore Arj, right? So it's kind of funny. My wife deemed this. That was kind of funny, and I just went with it. So anyway, you can follow me there for tarot stuff, for behind the scenes on the show, all of that good stuff. And I hope to see you there. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.